Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. The first case this morning is May versus Chrysler Group. Vadina?
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Deanne Medina, and I represent the plaintiff, appellant, cross-appellee, Otto May. As you know, this case was tried to a seven-day jury trial, and the decision by the jury rendered was in favor of my client, Otto May, $709,000 in compensatory damages and a $3.5 million punitive damage award. On post-trial motions, Judge Capalla vacated the punitive damage award, and that's why we're here today. We'd ask this court to reverse the vacation of the punitive damages and reinstate them. The instruction to the jury given at the trial was that in order to find punitive damages, that they had to find reckless disregard, that it was taken with knowledge that it may, what the defendant had done may violate the law, and that they needed to make a good faith effort to implement an anti-discrimination policy. And after listening to the testimony of all the witnesses for 7 days, listening to argument, the jury came back with a pretty substantial punitive damage verdict. They had the right, and they did, weigh all the credibility of the witnesses, all of the evidence, and found that Chrysler had not acted in good faith. And we believe Judge Capalla erred when he vacated that award, and there's many reasons why. First of all, they had an obligation to follow their anti-discrimination policy. They had to act in good faith to do that. They established a protocol that they would do when they would find the graffiti, and it's throughout the record. I'm sure you've reviewed the record. They would find the graffiti. They would clean it up. They would document it. They would discuss with witnesses in the area, and then they would put it into what became known at trial as the Kuhlborn binder. There were many instances, more than 10 indeed, that did not make it into the binder. They didn't even document some of the instances, and for sometimes there went days without cleaning up the graffiti. That in and of itself, they didn't follow their own policy with respect to what they had said they were going to do. McPherson and Kuhlborn, who were the two HR people, testified that these incidents did make it into the binder. However, upon examination, it was shown to the jury that there were many that were missing. And in fact, in Chrysler's brief, they only cite to 45 or 50 instances when it was shown at trial there were at least 60. Another really important issue is the issue of these crank calls and radio transmissions that were being relayed to my client, in which they were calling him nigger, F the Cuban Jew, all the horrible things that you've reviewed in the record. Otto complained about this to Scott Haller and other members of Chrysler, and nothing was ever done about it. In fact, Kim Kuhlborn, the HR person, testified at trial, yeah, I heard about that, but I don't know whatever happened with it. That in and of itself, if you just looked at that issue in and of itself, that warrants punitive damages. They knew that this was happening. It happened many times. The client complained about it, and they did nothing about it. They completely ignored it. It's almost as if Chrysler threw up their hands and said, look, it's so pervasive, we just give up. We just can't do anymore. But if you look at some of the other cases, the Weininger case that the defendant cites in their brief, in that case, it was one crank call, and the company interviewed witnesses, gave her part of a day off, I believe, put something on her phone to track calls for one incident. This happened numerous times in relation with all these other things going on, and they didn't do anything. They didn't interview the suspects. They hounded him for 2 or 3 months to give them a list of suspects, and he was reluctant to do it because he didn't want to point the finger. But when he finally did, McPherson testified, well, I didn't interview any of them because I didn't want to go around accusing people, but it was okay for Otto to do that. They didn't talk to anybody. Probably most telling was Judith Calliman, the Calliman memo that was talked about in the brief. Calliman's remarks made in that memo between Attorney Balo, Calliman, who was the corporate counsel, and McPherson, who was the HR person, said, even if we win, we still have Otto May. When questioned on the stand about that, McPherson said, well, what I meant by that was, even if we win, he still works here, so do we really win? That's malice. That's beyond reckless indifference. That went to show, look, we want to get rid of this guy. He's a pain. He's bringing us trouble. They weren't out to try to protect him. They weren't out to try to do everything they could to make it stop. They were looking for ways to get rid of him because he was a thorn in their side. Ms. Kuborn was biased in her investigation. She had her husband was a suspect, and she did not recuse herself from the investigation. Chrysler said that they could not install cameras because it would breach the union contract and that there was too much space. However, they never approached the union to discuss it with them to see if it was a viable option. They never posted signs that said, you're under surveillance. And their main issue was that if they did post, or if they did put a camera in and negotiated with the union, that they would not be able to terminate the person if they caught them. So they didn't do anything. But then they turned around a few years later, and in a squabble over people taking things off of other people's desks, they were able to install a hidden camera without the union's knowledge, which was found by one of the union members, in order to try to catch who was doing what.
Did Chrysler go outside to install that camera? Did they have an outside vendor?
I believe it was an outside vendor that came in and did it,
yes. Did they use a detective firm or something like that?
I'm not sure who they used, Your Honor.
I want to ask you about Kuborn and the conflict you talk about. The area where a fair number of the notes was found was called, is it the painter's crib or something like that?
Yeah, the tool crib, the paint department.
And wasn't
yes.
there a limited number of keys available to that to supervisory personnel?
At one point, yes, there were a limited number of keys. Now, one of those areas, I'm not sure which one you're talking about, they took the lock off at one point, so everyone had access, and then there was later graffiti found in that area.
There was an area that Mr. Kuborn had a key to,
mm-hmm.
and he was one of just a few who had a key to that area?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
And he was never interviewed?
I don't believe he was ever considered a suspect because he was eliminated in that list where he was not in the plant on times when the graffiti was found.
And his handwriting was not examined?
I believe his handwriting actually was examined.
And compared to the unknown handwriting?
Yes.
You're sure about that?
I'm pretty sure.
All right. And with respect to Ms. Kuborn, mm-hmm. there was a note, I think, in June of 2003 that didn't get to the police when the police came for
exactly.
Her. And it was Ms. Kuborn that held that note, wasn't
yes.
it?
Yes. She actually confiscated the note because Otto was the one calling the police. It was not the Chrysler wasn't calling the police. Otto's the one that called the police. The FBI got involved, and he called the Anti-Defamation League, as well as he tried to send a letter to the president of the company, which they blocked.
And that note included a death threat to Mr. May's family?
Yes. And so Ms. Kuborn confiscated the note and took it to the handwriting expert, and the police were like, well, there's nothing we can do because the chain of custody has been broken.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. So talking again about the cameras, again, like I said, they did go ahead and install cameras at a later time to catch these people that were stealing pencils. Now, my guess is they're going to say, well, we couldn't install cameras because it was such a large area and the graffiti was happening and it's 17 football fields and blah, 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 blah. Excuse my blah, blah, blahs. But anyway, it was contained more to the paint department, which is a large area, but there were at least, I think, five or six of these death threats were found in his toolbox. And his toolbox is not a toolbox. His toolbox is a toolbox. He's a pipe fitter. It's a huge toolbox. They easily could have installed a camera in or around that area to see who was putting these notes. When Otto was documenting, he was using his camera to take pictures because they were missing so much of the graffiti and things that were happening. They then told him at one point, no, you can't use your camera anymore. We have a policy. Now, I know this is not in the brief and this is outside the brief, but the Loudermilk case that was decided on last year stated that that's actually retaliation. Now, we don't have a retaliation claim in here, but that just goes to show that the defendant was not acting in good faith. Probably the most telling and the most compelling evidence, I believe, at the trial was the evidence presented by the handwriting expert, Jack Calvert. Jack Calvert was hired to allegedly help stop or prevent the harassment. He was given the unknown exemplars, which were the notes and the graffiti, about 25 of those, And then he was given samples, known samples of employees to compare those against. Tellingly, Chrysler voluntarily, not with Mr. Calvert's request, but voluntarily gave Calvert 50 to 60 samples of Otto May's writing to compare against the notes. They eliminated 26 people and told Mr. Calvert, don't worry about those people. They weren't in or around the plant on the days that graffiti was found, and so therefore we've eliminated them. Mr. May was absent at least three occasions. He was on vacation 1 week when notes were found. He was never eliminated as a suspect. And, in fact, they went ahead and gave him notes to try to have him pinned as the person. And the jury saw that. They heard it. They rendered a reasonable verdict in light of the evidence. And I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
Well, I do have one quick question for you, though. You asked us to reinstate the punitive damage verdict, but didn't Judge Capalla, in the alternative, grant a conditional
motion? Yes, he did, Your Honor.
For a new trial.
Yes, so we would have to go back to trial.
So it would have to be tried again.
Yes, I believe so.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Dupree.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Tom Dupree on behalf of Chrysler. Judge Capalla was correct when he concluded that Chrysler's conduct in this case came nowhere near the heightened level of malice and recklessness required for a punitive damage award. In fact, we have argued in our cross-appeal that there's no basis for employer liability at all in this case. This Court has repeatedly held that an employer is not strictly liable for a hostile environment perpetrated by coworkers. Quite the contrary, the employer is only liable in the event that its overall response to the totality of the circumstances can be deemed unreasonable or negligent. In fact, this Court has held, in many of the cases we discuss in our brief, that even though an employer's response to a hostile environment is imperfect, is deficient, even when the employer does not make use of all the alternative possible responses it could to a harassing situation, that does not mean that it was unreasonable. And in fact, this Court has repeatedly granted judgment as a matter of law to employers who conducted investigations that were described as deficient, imperfect, not textbook, because overall it was making good faith, albeit imperfect, efforts to halt the harassment.
But, Mr. Dupree, here it's a little bit like Groundhog Day, isn't it? Year after year after year, there are these horribly harassing notes and calls and so forth made, and the routine is the same. Document it, stick it in the Kuborn binder. Document it, stick it in the Kuborn binder. There's no ramping up or additional investigation done other than this sort of let's just file this one away.
Judge Tinder, I respectfully disagree. I think, in fact,
Couldn't a jury see it that way?
No, Your Honor. Absolutely not. Let me elaborate a bit on that. I think
Tell me where they stepped it up and where they took the investigation beyond just the compilation.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I'd be delighted, because I think the record is very strong in our favor on this point.
Let's hear about it.
As Your Honor correctly notes, we began by investigating the incident, documenting the graffiti, interviewing people who were nearby. That was our initial response. Your Honor is correct. But then we progressively strengthened the response as the harassment continued. For example, we increased security in the plant. We asked the managers to walk the halls. They got in early before their jobs started to walk the halls looking for anything suspicious. We reconfigured the physical plant. When a number of graffiti incidences occurred within a particular locker room, we actually dismantled the locker room and moved all of the employees' lockers to a different area precisely to protect the plaintiff. We granted him permission to park his car in a secure lot after there was an incident of graffiti aimed at his car. We hired a forensic examiner at our own expense to compare the handwriting samples. We held harassment training sessions.
The handwriting examiner wasn't hired until after the suit was filed. Is that right?
I believe that's right, Your Honor. What I think makes this case a little complex is that the plaintiff sued us at a certain point after the harassment began, but for a portion or a significant portion of the events at issue.
Several years.
About two years. There was active litigation. Right. At the same time, the notes were appearing. So to the extent the plaintiff says, oh, well, you know, you did this because, you know, for litigation to protect yourselves, well, he had sued us. But nonetheless, I think the key point here is that Chrysler's interests and the plaintiff's interests were perfectly aligned. We had every incentive to stop this harassment. We certainly did not turn a blind eye to it. In fact, there was testimony, unrebutted.
Why was he prohibited from photographing it then?
Because Chrysler has a standard, uniformly enforced policy that you cannot have cameras in an assembly plant, no matter who you are, for obvious trade secret reasons. Employees cannot bring in their digital cameras, their phone cameras, any kind of camera to focus things that they see in the plant. This is an undisputed record, uniformly enforced common sense policy. Now, I think just to close my answer to Your Honor's question about what we did, we also had town hall meetings. We conducted mandatory training sessions for the employees, emphasizing Chrysler's zero tolerance anti-harassment policy.
How many of those meetings were there?
There were two so-called town hall meetings, and then there was a series. I'm not sure of the exact number. I don't know if the record bears it out, but every supervisor was required to convene his or her employees to conduct hands-on anti-discrimination training to sensitize them.
The two meetings that you talk about, weren't they sort of back-to-back to get both shifts? Or?
No, Your Honor. The town hall meetings, I think, were actually spaced several apart. There was one town hall meeting, which you're right, it was several shifts. But then several months later, there was a separate town hall meeting. And so I respectfully disagree with the statement that the plaintiffs make that we did not increase our response. To the contrary, we deployed about a dozen or 15 different ways of attacking this problem vigorously, aggressively. We did not turn a blind eye. And in fact, when the harassment didn't stop, we kept trying new things. One point I didn't mention, which was enormously time insensitive, was we pulled all the gate rings and the timekeeping records for everyone who entered or exited the plant so we could figure out who was in the plant at the time this graffiti appeared. Hundreds of hours were devoted to this painstaking, exhaustive examination of these gate ring records to see if we could identify the perpetrator. That was yet another thing we did when our initial responses weren't successful.
And that was Ms. Kuborn pulling those?
She primarily handled that effort. That's right.
Didn't she have a problem with her husband as a suspect in this?
Well, she recused herself, Your Honor, from
She's pulling all these. She's deciding which gate rings to pull and so forth. She's recused. I don't understand.
Well, she is recused from any aspect of the investigation that involved her husband.
She decides what goes in the binder and what doesn't, right?
Well,
it's her binder.
It's her binder, Your Honor. But as she testified, and the record is clear,
it's a funny way to be recused.
The binder was simply her way of memorializing a vast amount of record evidence that was developed over this case. But let me just cut right to this.
Wasn't she the one who decided not to give the note to the police when they showed up on the June 03 note?
I think I respectfully disagree with that characterization. That's certainly how the plaintiff pegs it, that she refused to give the note. I think what the record shows is that she had given it to our forensic examiner to take a look at. We gave the note to the police, so it's not as though she burned the note.
About a week later, right?
That's right. That's right. So it's not as though she burned the note. We were trying to get to the answer. I mean, this is obviously not a case where she said, oh, my gosh, let me dispose of this. To the contrary, we were trying.
The note contains a death threat to Mr. May's family, and the police are there looking for it.
Well,
it's pretty important for the police to have that.
And the police got it. Again, I think this plaintiff's suggestion that in this instance we were obstructing the investigation, I think is false. We were doing our best to solve the mystery. We gave the note to the police.
It's hard for me to understand how a person is recused from an investigation, but she's right in the middle of it.
Well, she's recused from investigating her husband. In other words, there are many different workers.
She attends these meetings with her boss and with telephone meetings with Ms. Coleman on the line and so forth. But if it comes to a discussion of her husband as a potential suspect, she steps out of the room, or how does that work?
Well, yes. Well, Your Honor, she. I guess I don't want to overstate the point, but there are hundreds of employees, thousands of employees in this plant, and so
well, there are only 19 on Mr. May's list that he gave, and Mr. Kuborn was one of those 19,
yes.
And he had a run-in with Mr. Kuborn. And Mr. Kuborn had a key to the painter's crib that not everybody had.
But Your Honor, again, to the extent of the plaintiff suggesting that Mr. Kuborn somehow was given special treatment or was not investigated, the forensic examiner searched his handwriting and said he didn't do it. And so I think that there's absolutely zero evidence.
Get that report in 07?
We got the report later, but we obviously were getting preliminary reports. I mean, certainly if the forensic examiner had been able to solve the mystery on day one, it's not as though he would have withheld this information. I mean, we were actively, vigorously trying to solve this mystery, just as the police were and just as the FBI were. Mr. Kuborn was rigorously scrutinized, and the point that he was on...
Did any of the people involved on this investigative team have some detective experience or some sort of investigational training that, like, police get?
Well, I don't think the record reflects that they do, but they were human resources specialists. So to the extent that the investigation included, for instance, interviewing witnesses, talking to people, developing relationships and rapports to get clues, these are exactly the people you want to do it. These are people who know the plant, who know the workers, who are good at just sitting down and saying, tell me what's going on. So I think the answer is yes, they absolutely did have the requisite skills to conduct this investigation. With regard to your honors...
Had they ever done anything like this? Was this a new thing for them?
Not on this magnitude. In other words, certainly they have done things like this in the sense that you would have one employee harassing another and that sort of thing. That's what HR folks do. But nothing ever had occurred on this scale.
So as they did all of this stuff that you described, did it deter the incidents? Did they diminish? I know they stopped finally in 05, but for about a three-year period, it seemed pretty continuous.
Well, it diminished. In other words, there if you looked at, you graphed the timing, there were more incidents at the outset, and then in the last year or so of the period, there were just a handful. So in other words, there were a number of incidents at the beginning, then it gradually tapered off and, of course, ceased entirely. Now, I think one other point to emphasize is that Your Honor is right in that if you measure this by the time of the first incident to the time of the last incident, it was about a three-year period. However, these incidents only occurred approximately once a month. Now, again, any incident is intolerable, and I'm not suggesting that's acceptable to have something once a month. But at the same time, I think it suggests that this was not a situation where things were appearing every hour or every day. It's once a month, occurring in an assembly plant that's much larger than O'Hare Airport. And many of these instances of graffiti were things that were left at 3 a.m. on a restroom stall, which is virtually impossible to try to catch someone in the act.
What about there were a lot of notes in his toolbox?
There were some, yes. They were left in his toolbox.
Eight or nine, wasn't it?
I beg your pardon?
Eight or nine.
I think that's about right.
A camera posted in the vicinity of that toolbox, which I think is about the size of your podium, isn't it, might capture some.
Well, 2 points on that, Your Honor. One is that we examined the possibility of installing cameras. So, in other words, it wasn't something we ignored, and certainly people might say, well, you should have done this or you should have done that, but our point is that this was a reasonable judgment. Number one, installing cameras would not be practical given the size of the plant, the fact that many of these...
Well, yeah, to cover 4 million square feet, right, but to cover a toolbox, it's a little easier.
Well, if you know that it's going to be in that one place, yes.
That's where those notes kept popping up.
But then the second point, Your Honor, is that installing hidden cameras would have violated the collective bargaining agreement. And so we had a legal...
There was a portion of the CBA that prohibited cameras?
This court has held, and it's a fact, that installing hidden surveillance cameras in a workplace is subject to a collective bargaining agreement.
How did you do it for the theft then?
Several years after the fact, what they did was they went in, they installed one hidden camera, and then the union grieved it, and they ripped the stuff out immediately.
I see. But you would do it for a theft.
Well, number one, this was several years later, and number two, that was a different situation, and arguably it was something that shouldn't have been done.
You go ahead.
I was going to say, to the extent the plaintiff's argument, which I believe is their argument, is they are saying, Chrysler, you should have violated the collective bargaining agreement by installing hidden cameras. I think that simply would be unreasonable, given that you have thousands of unionized employees, and the notion that Chrysler would jeopardize its good relationship.
So the union wouldn't sit down with Chrysler to help eradicate this harassment. The union condoned it, promoted it?
Oh, I certainly wouldn't say anyone condoned the harassment, Your Honor. We approached the union to explore the possibility, again, showing that we tried and we thought about this and we focused on it. We explored the possibility. And when we had an informal conversation with the head of the union saying, well, what would you think about putting in a hidden camera? His response was, well, if the hidden camera catches the perpetrator in the act, you, Chrysler, in order to get our permission to do this, you have to promise you won't fire the guy. That simply was an unreasonable condition. It was inappropriate. We had every right to fire someone who was committing these horrific acts, and so the fact that the union leader was conditioning his approval on our pledge not to fire this individual was an unacceptable condition. At a minimum, was a reasonable judgment.
And that was a decree by the union official. You didn't attempt to negotiate that?
We had our HR people contact him again. I don't want to characterize it as a formal bargaining session. I think it was more in the lines of just calling up and saying, hey, we've got this situation. We're trying to explore creative solutions to this. What would you think about X? And he said, well, don't fire the guy if you catch him.
What did Mr. McPherson say he meant when he wrote that note about how do we win where we still have Otto May?
I think that conversation was occurring at the time that the parties were discussing settlement and possible resolutions to the case. And Mr. May, as of today, is still a valued, happy employee at the Chrysler plant.
Getting rid of him would have been a good thing, according to Mr. McPherson?
Oh, I don't think so at all, Your Honor. I don't think so at all. He remains a valued employee to this day. I think that comment was simply talking about the possible routes. Well, if this happens, he would still be here. If this doesn't happen, he would leave the company. If we paid him this, he would agree to this as part of a termination agreement. I don't think that suggests malice or anything. I think this is just a statement of fact about one possible way that this case could have gotten resolved. To the contrary, Chrysler employees poured their heart and soul into stopping this harassment. There is absolutely zero evidence that anyone for one second condoned what happened here. We were committed to rooting this thing out from day one. More time was spent on this matter than on any employment matter in the history of the plant. 45 years. This was our number one case. Kim Kuborn testified that she spent 3 hours a day on this case for 3 years trying to stop it. How can that not be reasonable? We tried everything, Your Honor. We progressively increased our response over time. We tried to eradicate this harassment. It was intolerable. It was hateful. It wasn't something we wanted to have happen. We tried to stomp this out. I see my red light is on. Unless there are further questions, we
thank
ask
you very
that
much,
judgment firm. Thank you.
How many times?
4 minutes. Thank you, Your Honor. Just to clarify some points that Mr.
Dupree.
Totally. I'm sorry. First of all, let's talk about the ramping up. They didn't really ramp up their efforts. This went on for 3.5 years. The Chrysler has taken this position, oh, it was once a month for if you average it out. That's not true. They're saying there's 45 to 50. We're saying there's 60. The record shows that there's 60. The whole issue about the camera, the union did not say we will have to fire we can't fire the person that gets caught. They're saying that if you put up cameras and you kept someone sleeping on the job or you kept someone doing something outside of the harassment that's going on, you can't fire that person. But the fact of the matter is McPherson.
Is that in the record?
Yes, that is in the record. And McPherson.
They limited their prohibition against firing to somebody who got picked up for not doing the things that they're looking for?
That was the issue about the collective bargaining agreement.
I can look in the record and find.
I'm pretty sure you can, Your Honor.
I'm not pretty sure. I wonder if I can look in the record and find what they said was you can't fire them unless they catch the perpetrator or the vile acts.
I believe that was in Rick Barry's testimony, if you look to the record there. The other issue about that, the whole thing, is that McPherson testified he never talked to the union. He never sat down and talked to them.
Could you tell me where in the record I would find that statement by the union?
I would look at Rick Barry's testimony. Rick Barry was the union. It's his in the rebuttal towards the end. With respect to Kuborn, there was no testimony as to how she recused herself. She just said that when it came to her husband, she would not participate in the investigation. For Mr. Dupree to go on and on about how she did, that's not in the record. A lot of the things that he said are not in the record. And with respect to your question about whether or not this had happened before, if they had dealt with this kind of an incident before, they had. There was a prior incident, not to the scale of Mr. Mays, but there was a female employee who was getting sexual. There were things on elevators and on walls and things like that, graffiti. So they had prior notice. This is not the first time they had dealt with an instance of an unknown harasser with graffiti. So that, again, goes to our punitive damages argument. Again, the fact that there were 60 incidents, not 45 or 50, the information with respect to the handwriting expert, They were not communicating with him. He testified that I didn't hear from them. His report, as you said, Your Honor, did not come out until 2007, and that's when he was able to say definitively, I don't know who did it. That was his definitive answer. I can't tell you. Without more samples, I cannot tell you who did it, which they never provided to
him.
This
is after the lawsuit was filed.
This was after the lawsuit was filed, exactly. The whole issue about the things that they said they did 12 to 15, dozens of things to stop. If you look at the manager's testimony, they talk about that they were told, get it, document it, put it in the binder. And like you said, it's like Groundhog Day. It's like you keep doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. There's no evidence that they talked to anyone else about phone cameras, that they couldn't have their phone cameras in the plant. The town hall meetings that he talked about with Mr. Hughes, if you look at his testimony, he talks about those meetings were held also to talk about paint issues or issues in the paint department that were going on. And, oh, by the way, stop harassing Otto May. It was not just for that sole purpose. There was another purpose to that. They keep going back to the beginning of the harassment when they did the McPherson talks, when they did these things, and saying, look what we did. But then it continued. It went on for another 2.5 years. It's not as if this went on and they did all these things and expanded over time. They sort of concentrated their efforts at the beginning and then sort of threw their hands up and went, well, he sued us. What are we going to do? So we would respectfully request that you reverse the judge's order vacating the punitive damages and affirm the court's judgment on our liability. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Medina. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.